States against Dixon. Mr. Truitt.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Truitt and I represent the appellant Marcus Dixon. Your Honors, several constitutional issues have been raised, but before getting to those issues, consistent with the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, I think the first question is the definition of travels. Marcus Dixon submits that Congress's choice of the present tense, combined with the rest of 18 U.S.C. 2250, would indicate that to be held responsible under this statute, a defendant would have to travel while being subject to SORNA, not just any state registration scheme, regardless of the state.
So if Dixon's travel, let me see if I can get this, if Dixon's travel had occurred after SORNA's enactment and after the February 2008 interim rule, do you believe that a conviction under Section 2250 would still pose constitutional problems? In other words, is the fact that Dixon's travel predated SORNA the determinative issue?
Yes and no, and I'll answer that briefly. That would be the determinative issue as far as my statutory construction argument. Certainly the ex post facto argument would go away, but I still believe that there is absolutely no causal connection to interstate commerce or any of the three prongs of Lopez on both the registration and in its criminal enforcement counterpart. And so, yes, there would still be a fatal defect under the Commerce Clause, perhaps under the notice requirements of due process, and there would still be my problems with the separation of powers and the Attorney General essentially legislating who is covered by SORNA, at least to some degree.
Can you explain why SORNA is not a valid exercise of congressional authority to regulate persons or things in interstate commerce? And, I mean, has any court agreed with your position that Congress exceeded its power under the Commerce Clause by enacting SORNA?
Yes. No appellate court, Your Honor. The only court of appeal which has ruled is in the May case, which is the Eighth Circuit. And the government. And quite frankly, the Eighth Circuit's treatment of the three prongs of Lopez is not only cursory, but I think is incorrect. And getting to your question about the second prong of Lopez, as far as people and things in interstate commerce, the reason it's violated, the registration requirements have no interstate connection whatsoever. The criminal counterpart under 2250 only kicks in when travel has been completed. It's not regulating how somebody...
it's just like guns, right? It's just like guns. They travel in interstate commerce. They come to rest. Many years later, someone is prosecuted for being a felon in possession. So what's the difference?
Well, I don't believe that people are commodities, and it
is... I don't
know
what that means. I don't know what utility that remark has. Look, you have a problem, right? These people traveling around, and there's a concern they're endangering kids wherever they go. That's a national problem, right? No individual state can deal effectively with that.
Well,
that's why you have a federal government.
Well, giving on the assumption that it is a national problem,
assumption it's a national problem? What's that comment?
It's not an issue of the appeal, and it hasn't been briefed, but I don't necessarily agree to the extent of the national problem.
Many statutes are adopted by majority vote rather than unanimous vote. Congress has found it's a national problem, and there we are.
Yes. It's a problem that all 50 states had previously addressed, and it's a police power a general police power problem,
you really don't want to suggest that the law is the way it was back when the four horsemen were sitting. Once the Supreme Court upheld the hot cargo clause, arguments of that sort were all over.
Your Honor, yes, it's been expanded, but I would submit, as I do in my reply brief, that the Commerce Clause and has to have some boundary. Whether this is the boundary or not, it is up to this Court, but that there has to be some check, and the Supreme Court and Morrison, Lopez, Jones has found that there is elastic limits to what areas of life the federal government...
Morrison and Lopez were cases in which the statute did not require proof that anything had ever moved in commerce.
Correct, and I am not saying that
there is a commerce element in this statute. Your client turned out to be a thing that moved in commerce, but there's absolutely nothing in the Commerce Clause that distinguishes between things, whether they're animate or not.
But on this, with all due respect...
Otherwise you wouldn't have the Mann Act, right?
Indeed.
Well, I'm glad that the Court brought that up, because for the Mann Act, or say for the Protect Act, and there's numerous other statutes, the statute itself, and the reason that they have been upheld by pretty much every circuit, is it's travel with the purpose of committing criminal activity. So the Mann Act is distinguishable. SORNA just uses the magic language of travels in interstate commerce.
What does that have to do with commerce? I don't know why you're spending all your time on commerce. Really.
Maybe because I asked him about it. Why do you need actual notice of SORNA's registration requirements? And for our visitors, SORNA is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. Why do you need actual notice? I mean, it's undisputed that he was well aware of his obligation to register in Indiana, correct?
Yes, and he signed a South Carolina form, which is in the government's appendix, and it does not advise of either SORNA's predecessor, the Wetterling Act, but it does say that if you go to another state, you have to update.
So does Indiana have any procedures in place to inform offenders of their registration duties pursuant to SORNA?
No. As of now, Ohio is the only state who has enacted SORNA, which is important. In your original question, under the Lambert v. California case, we argue that if you are being prosecuted criminally for purely passive activity, meaning failing to do something, that you need actual notice under due process. And where that becomes important, for instance, in Marcus Dixon's case or anybody similarly situated, is by analogy, if Marcus Dixon and I decided to go on a golf trip to the state of Michigan and crossed over Indiana's lines, and it was planned for a 7-day golf trip, he wouldn't have to know, and this just goes back to there's no regulation on how he travels, he wouldn't have to notify anybody that he was leaving, travel in any particular way, or notify anybody he was there. He would be in compliance with the Wetterling Act, which was SORNA's predecessor, South Carolina law, and Indiana law, and all of that is cited in my statement of the facts. Upon his return, believing that he was in perfect compliance with all those things, he would be able to be held criminally responsible under 2250.
You can't be serious about failing to do something can never be criminal without notice. What? You fail to feed your children, they starve to death, and you can't be prosecuted because you didn't get a letter saying you got to feed your kids?
Well, in the Lambert case, and I'm not saying, clearly that is neglect of a dependent. You have an obligation to provide for your children. In the Lambert case, Los Angeles passed a city ordinance requiring felons to register. Lambert was prosecuted under that. And the United States Supreme Court, and I believe the facts in that case are analogous to SORNA.
The whole point of Lambert was the court held that no reasonable person would have understood that Los Angeles had this statute that at the time was pretty weird. But we've agreed, you agreed in answer to Judge Posner's question, and it's perfectly plain on this record, that your client had actual knowledge of the requirement to register in Indiana.
Yes.
So the thing that was important about Lambert is not true here. And as you know, Lambert has not been a case that the Supreme Court has proved anxious to extend. Lambert is the beginning and the end of the Lambert line.
Yes. Now, the one point that I would put out would make on that point is SORNA is dramatically more intrusive in its obligations. I cite all the differences, and I don't have time to run through the litany of the differences between SORNA and state law. But, for instance, Mr. Dixon could register and update in
I'm puzzled by that. Is there any doubt that if your client had complied with Indiana law by registering, as he was required to do, there's no problem under this federal statute?
That remains to be seen, Your Honor, and this is why I say that.
Well, what would be the situation in which he could be liable under the federal law if he had complied with Indiana law?
A strict reading, I would hope that there's no U.S. attorney who would do that. However, the SORNA, the Title 42 portion of SORNA, requires, number one, actual notice of, and it lists all the different notice requirements. And
could you answer my question, please? I said,
yes.
What is the circumstance under which, if he complied with his Indiana obligations, he would nonetheless be liable under federal law?
Because if he complied with Indiana, he could have sent a letter to the sheriff of the county that he was residing in and given address, name, and that's it. SORNA requires far more information and in-person notification and proof of actual notification. And 2250 says...
Just lost. If you notify the sheriff, that presumably is actual notification. Are you suggesting that under federal law... You have to show up in person, and you can't act by mail or internet.
That is correct, Your Honor. So if he strictly complied with Indiana law by sending a letter and only giving what Indiana or South Carolina required of him, he would still be deficient in what SORNA requires.
Where do I see that?
In my statement of the facts, I go through.
No. There's some federal statute you want me to look at for this.
It's 42.
Title 42 is 1,000, really, really long.
I understand, Your Honor. 16.9.11 et al. Through.
16.9.11 what?
9.13, 9.12.
All right. Well, I've got your starting point.
But again, regardless of the constitutional issues, Congress knows its verbs and says once the person subject to SORNA or under the obligations of SORNA specifically, not just a general proxy state situation, but specifically SORNA, and travels interstate.
But the argument you were just making was irrelevant to whether the travel is before or after, right?
No, I was moving on back to the first issue. I was.
What about this ex post facto issue? That's an interesting issue. But doesn't this Justice Department regulation take care of that problem?
Are you referring to the interim rule of the Attorney General?
I don't know.
Oh,
you tell me.
Well, I don't think that can cure a statutory application.
Well, I don't know. If he's authorized by the statute to adopt these regulations, why isn't the regulation, in effect, the statute?
Well, leaving aside the separation of powers issue, which I've raised.
I'm talking about ex post facto.
I think the analysis, whether it's his rule being considered legislation or the legislation itself, is whether he is being punished greater or for conduct that was in the past and was prior to the statute.
Yeah, but if the regulation gives him an opportunity to register, then there's no punishment.
Why here's an interesting...
The punishment is the punishment for failing to register. And if, and I do think if you just look at the statute without the regulation, there's a problem because you're not given any time to register. But the regulation gives you time, right? So you can register and then you're not in trouble.
That is not true, Your Honor, because the regulation did not give any amnesty period or say that... that
I'm talking about amnesty. I'm talking about a period in which you have to register before you'll be prosecuted.
The interim letter, and if I can finish my answer.
Always
why
answer,
do lawyers so always say that? Do they think that the judge would ask a question but forbid the answer? What sense does that make?
Just trying to provide a courtesy to the court, Your Honor.
I wish lawyers would think before they spoke.
I'm sorry. In answer to your question, the interim rule merely stated that offenders who were not in the prison population or being sentenced currently, regardless of the date of conviction, were to be liable to the reporting requirements of SORNA. In Marcus Dixon's case, he became, under SORNA, he becomes criminally liable on the fourth day after travel that he fails to register. That occurred in May of 2006. SORNA was enacted in July of 2006, and the interim rule making SORNA applicable to him was February 28th, well past the four-day limit where criminal liability attached to him.
Well, that February regulation, then, how much time did it give him to register?
Zero. And I point out that Congress specifically said that the Attorney General was to prescribe rules for getting people like Marcus Dixon registered. To this day, not the interim rule, not the subsequent SMART guidelines, nothing. To this, as we stand here on October 24th, there are no rules that have been developed by the Attorney General's office to register people like Marcus Dixon, or even notify them of their obligation if they are not in the registration population currently. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Truitt. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Truitt. Your Honor, my name is John Machasek, and I represent the United States, and normally I think it's best to jump in and start answering or talking about the questions that have been raised by the panel.
Except I want to ask you a question.
Okay, I was going to ask your indulgence for a moment, but Your Honor.
I'm in a non-indulgent mood. No. The statute under which Dixon was convicted prescribes criminal penalties for knowing failure to update a registration as required, that's the operative word, by SORNA. If Indiana has not yet implemented SORNA, how is it possible for Dixon to update his registration as required by SORNA, particularly when the registration requirements under Indiana law and SORNA are different?
Well, Your Honor, the criminal provision of SORNA, 2250, requires that the sex offender register with the state, an individual who is required to register with the state. It doesn't say that it's not an element of that offense that the defendant register and provide the whole panoply of information that's required by SORNA.
When does he have to register?
Well, if the individual is released from prison, he has, I believe, 3 days after release from prison.
Yes, I know, but if he's released before SORNA takes effect, then when does he have to
register? You mean as in this case? An individual who had a prior conviction was released. If he travels into a state...
Look, I know that. Now, you traveled before SORNA became effective.
Well, when was Mr. Dixon required? I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't know you were asking.
I am talking about this case.
Your question was...
I know that's surprising, right? No,
Your Honor, your question was a little bit broader than that, I thought. But Mr. Dixon,
does he have to register, given that he traveled before the statute became effective?
Mr. Dixon would have had to been required to register once the statute became applicable to him. And that at that point was
when was that?
February 27th of 2007.
When the
Attorney General issued his regulation that made it clear.
Oh, wait a second. The statute was enacted when?
July 27th of 2006,
which was the 25th anniversary of Adam Walsh's death.
And why didn't he have to register then?
Because it was unclear, based on the language of the statute, that it would have applied to him at that point.
I don't think that's the right answer. He was required to register then. He was required to register earlier as a matter of state law. The question is, when was there a supplemental federal registration requirement? And that's the retroactivity question that the Attorney General is going to answer.
Well, Mr. Dixon would have been required to register under...
Not would have been. The subjunctive is wrong. He was required to register.
Yes. He was required to register under Indiana law and South Carolina.
Federal law, please. When was he required to
under
register?
The Jacob Wetterling Act.
Federal law, when was he required to register?
He would have been required to register.
What the would have been? When was he required to register?
He was required to register when he moved to Indiana under the...
When was that?
Jacob Wetterling Act. It was sometime in June of 2006.
But that's before the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but Judge Easterbrook is talking about other statutes that were in effect.
I'm talking about SORNA.
Well, I don't know which question to answer now.
Well, answer mine. I don't think they're really different questions, but why don't you answer mine? Then we'll answer
mine. The answer to registration under SORNA was effective February 27th.
But why? If the statute takes effect July 27th, 2006, and it says that you have to register if you've traveled and so on, why doesn't the duty arise then? What in the statute postpones the duty to register?
You mean from the enactment date, Your Honor?
Yes.
I think it was the delegation of the authority to the Attorney General to specify the application of the law to individuals who'd been convicted prior to the enactment of SORNA.
You have to go back to the text. Your answer depends on the first word of 2250A. Whoever is required to register under this act. Right? Anybody whose conviction post-dates July 27, 2006 is such a person. There's also a clause that says the Attorney General will decide whether somebody is in the whoever is required to register category for people whose convictions predate that date. The Attorney General made that decision effective in July of 2007. That's also, by the way, the holding of United States against Madera, the 11th Circuit case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so I believe that for purposes of SORNA, Mr. Dixon would have had to register after the Attorney General issued his decision. There were other laws that required his registration.
So the February 27 decision, what did it provide?
It provided that...
So far as it applies to Dixon.
It provided that individuals that were convicted prior to the effective date of SORNA, July 27, 2006, were covered, those convictions were included under...
How much time did it give him to register on February 27th?
No time.
Well, I didn't understand. February 27th, he finds out that he's required to register, and he has to register the same day?
Well, Your Honor, I think a reasonable, this may come in with prosecutorial discretion, but...
No. Your answer is he was required by state law to register as soon as he arrived in Indiana, and that registration, had it been completed, was perfectly sufficient for the purpose of the federal statute.
What
he had to do in February was nothing had he complied with his legal obligations before then. You've now got a set of people who have not complied with their legal obligations and a federal statute that, at least as you understand it, is a continuing offense.
Yes.
Those people are, of course, now in a pickle because they've been scofflaws for an extended period.
Yes.
Could I try something with you?
Could we finish this slide, because complete this analysis? Why isn't that ex post facto? That is, on February 27th, you say to a bunch of people, you are guilty of violating this federal law, even though until February 27th, you didn't know that yet that you had to register under the law. Under another law, you had to register, but under the federal law, you didn't know until February 27th.
Well, the district court's answer to that question, Your Honor.
What's your answer?
So that it was a continuing violation because of his failure to register under the pre-existing federal law when he moved to Indiana, the Wetterling Act, which required registration.
Yes, but you can't, under the ex post facto clause, you can't super add punishment to crimes that have already been committed.
You can if those crimes are continuing, and that is, for example, United States versus...
On February 26th, would it make a difference if he registered July 28th? Would that make any difference in your argument?
I'm sorry, July 28th of
2006? Would that make any difference in your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, he would have been registered at that point. He would have been registered for purposes of SORNA. He would have had violated the Wetterling Act up until that point.
The letter?
Pardon me?
So he could be prosecuted?
He could have been prosecuted under the Wetterling Act.
No, under SORNA.
Not if he registered July 27th.
Why? July 28th, I said.
July 28th of 2006, if he had registered at that point, his registration would have been in place.
No, but he would have had one day in which he had violated the law, right?
Yes, Your Honor, technically.
What do you mean technically?
Well, you're right. He would have been in violation
Wouldn't
of the law.
Wouldn't that be ex post facto?
No, because the law became into effect that day, and he was unregistered at that point.
Don't you understand? How can you punish a person for something that he did before the law took effect?
Well, and the other question is, how
you
can...
You don't expect him to register the first day the law is in effect, do you? Or do you?
As a practical matter, no.
What do you mean as a practical matter? How about as a legal matter?
Yes, according to the letter of the law, he would have had to have been registered the day after the law took effect.
Sounds ex post facto to me.
Can we go through a little... Given the differences in Indiana's registration requirements and the requirements under SORNA, if Dixon had registered as required under South Carolina and Indiana law, could he still have been convicted for his failure to update his registration as required by SORNA? For example, under South Carolina law, Dixon was obligated to register as a sex offender in Indiana within 10 days of arrival. If he had registered on the 7th day, okay, could he still be prosecuted under SORNA? Since the statute, since SORNA, only provides a 3-day registration window.
He could have No, Your Honor. When he initially moved to Indiana, and if he had waited 10 days to register as required by South Carolina law, that would not have been a violation of SORNA because SORNA was not in effect at that point.
So
when he relocated.
So if he'd registered on the seventh day, he couldn't have been prosecuted under SORNA, even though the statute only provides a three-day window. That's what you're saying.
When he initially moved to Indiana, no, he couldn't have been prosecuted under SORNA because it wasn't in effect at that time.
Are those registration requirements unique to SORNA, like the three-day window and other more onerous requirements than those existing under state laws presently enforceable?
The registration requirements, are they more onerous? Is that what you're saying?
No, I know they're more onerous. I'm asking if they're presently enforceable because it seems no state has implemented SORNA with the software that the Attorney General was supposed to develop and make available to the states, has that been made available?
No, Your Honor. It has not yet been made available.
So how can a state implement SORNA if it doesn't even have the software to do it with?
Your Honor, I think you're asking if SORNA is the requirements of to register under 2258 are in effect at this point. If an individual goes to register in Indiana, if he cannot provide all the information that's required by the federal statute, I would think that that would present to the present a defense of impossibility with regard if there was a prosecution for an attempted prosecution for failing to provide that information, which I don't believe any assistant U.S. attorney would attempt to prosecute somebody for. If he registered, though, under the mechanisms that were available to him in the state, whether or not it had implemented SORNA, then I think he would be in compliance.
I want to come back to the timing question. I've now gone and looked at the indictment. The indictment says from on or about February 28, 2007 to on or about April 5, 2007, Dixon, being required to register, didn't register. Was the jury asked to make any special verdict about which dates of those dates he didn't register?
No, Your Honor. This was a bench trial.
It was a bench trial. Did the judge make findings about which dates he didn't register?
No, Your Honor. The judge.
Well, that's the potential problem that Judge Posner raises. If the indictment had said something like, on or about April 5th in the Northern District of Indiana, he didn't register, then it would clearly be charging an act after the Attorney General's regulation, or failure to act after the Attorney General's regulation, and within time to have found out about the regulation. But we have the possibility, I suppose, that the district judge thought he failed to register on February 28, but did register on March 1st. And I think under this indictment he would be guilty, but that's what creates the ex post facto problem, that he didn't do anything after the Attorney General's regulation, the triggering event, and didn't have time to do anything.
Well, I see the argument. He didn't do it.
Is there any way in this record that suggests a finding by the judge that Dixon failed to register some reasonable period of time after notice could have been given after the Attorney General's regulation?
No, there's nothing like that in the record, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well,
it's not a really serious problem. Suppose the Attorney General's regulation comes out at, 5 p.m.
I see my lights on there.
Are we going to go through this again?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
What is going on?
They want to escape. That's what's going on.
I don't understand this. If the Attorney General's regulation, say, is issued at 5 p.m. on the 27th, there isn't any way in which he can register before the 28th. And I think your view is he's guilty.
Yes, Your Honor, because...
Even though it's physically impossible to comply.
Because the law would have come out, would have been in effect at that point, and he would have been in noncompliance at that point.
And yet he couldn't comply. Because he didn't know about the regulation. Something wrong with your argument.
But it's not a specific intent crime. It's a general intent crime.
No, this is not a problem of intent. This is a problem of ex post facto. You have to do something after the federal rule becomes applicable to you. And if your view is that there's an instantaneous violation the moment the Attorney General signs the regulation, then every fact necessary for conviction precedes the law's application. And that's the ex post facto problem. The only way to save the ex post facto problem is to say that some element of the offense was committed after its effectiveness. But you've now taken a legal position that says every element of the offense can be committed before the act's effectiveness. And that was, of course, the point of my question. We've got this on or about date from the Attorney General's regulation to a month later. The month later is a post-effective act or inaction. The Attorney General's signing date, well, that's the instantaneous pre-effectiveness act.
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't think I'm saying that everything had occurred before the act became effective. I'm saying that as of the moment the act became effective, there was the obligation to register,
well,
which didn't happen.
That pretty much defines what an ex post facto law is. Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.